Well, hey guys, I am so excited for today. I'm excited for this series. It's the last week of the series called The Church. Last week, if you're here, you heard Pastor Clint give just an amazing message, just like Pastor Rodney said. Actually, me and my wife had the day off last week, and we still came to church because we knew it was going to be a great word, and it was just so impacting to us. And so I encourage you, if you haven't listened to it, go back and take a listen. But one of the things that Pastor Clint talked about was what we call the 1-to-4 ratio. Now, that's one of those things, that terms that we as a staff, as leadership, kind of look at and we hold dear to. And as I know it sounds a little strange, but basically the 1-to-4 ratio says this, that for every one person committed, we know that there'll be four people connected. Okay, for every one person committed, four people connect. And so let me illustrate that out for you. So a few years ago, we had a young man who started coming to our student ministry. And he would just come with along with his friends, and he started to get to know Jesus. He actually gave his heart to Jesus here in our student ministry. He came on our 252 internship program and started interning at the church. All the while, his family did not go to church here. In fact, his dad was a self-proclaimed atheist, didn't believe in God, but here he was. And so after a few months of this going on, after seeing this transformation, his family, his mom, dad, and sister, three others, decided to start to come to church just to visit. And then they would come back again to visit, and they keep coming back. And eventually his dad, who was an atheist, gave his heart to Jesus here in this very church. Come on. He got baptized here. Their whole family started attending here. In fact, his dad, Scott, is actually one of our head ushers, serves here every weekend, serves multiple times on a weekend, and is one of my good friends. Even though last week he cheered for his Packers, who played against my Cowboys. And so even though I love him, I question his salvation just a little bit. But here's what the 1-to-4 ratio simply says, that for every one person committed, we'll see four people connected. And that's exactly what happened in that family's life. And so I know that sounds kind of businessy, but for us, it's something we hold dear to. And if you're taking notes, here's the very first and most important thing I want you to know is this, that to people who don't know God, connection is more basic than Christ. Connection is more basic than Christ. Now listen to me very clearly. Hear what I'm saying. I'm not saying it's better. I'm not saying it's more important. I'm just saying it's more basic. Okay? So for example, if I'm just a complete stranger, I don't go to North Church, and I meet my friend Zach, you know, it's easy for me to say, it's basic for me to say, hey, you know what, I like Zach, he's a nice guy, I guess I'll visit his church. That's much more basic than to say, you know what, this Jesus guy who was born of a virgin, lived a sinless life, died on a cross, rose again 3 days later, oh man, he's totally cool. That's a harder leap, especially for an unchurched person. So it's more basic to be connected with someone that they can physically see and touch than Jesus. Now, once they make that connection and then they start coming, man, their life is transformed when they get to meet Jesus for the first time. And so, as we look into this at a deeper level, here's what I kind of want to throw out to you. Because we as a church play an important role in the eternal souls of people, right? There is no force more powerful for the kingdom than the church. Jesus has commissioned us, you and me, the church, to be the hands and feet of him in this world, to go out and to make disciples. That's what we're put on this planet to do. And there's no greater cause, there's no greater source of hope than the church. And so, as I was studying the church, I came across this statistic. The study was done, and it found out, for those of you guys taking notes, that of all first-time guests at any church, on average, 12% of them would get casually involved. Of all first-time guests, 12% will get casually involved, and 4% will get committed at a deeper level. 4% will get committed. And so I want to kind of game that out a little bit, if that's okay, all right? We're going to do some math in church, and no, that's not a sin, okay? So let's imagine every weekend at North Church, we had 3 new people coming through our doors, okay? So in 1 year, that's 52 weeks, we'll have how many people? 156. I had to look down at my notes to get that number right, okay? Don't feel bad if you're like, I don't know. 156 new people every year. Let's just imagine that's a number. I'm not saying those are actual numbers. I'm just saying this is the numbers we're working with. So if that were the case, then we know that of that 156 people, 18 will get casually involved in church over the course of that year. And 6 will become committed at a deeper level. But here's the number I want you to notice. 132 will never get connected here. 132 eternal souls will never get connected here. And if that doesn't bother you, I don't know what would. That is important for us to know. And these are just averages. We get to change that. We have an impact on that. But all of us are called to this mission of the church. Right? There is no clergy lady thing here. There's not people who are on staff who do all the work. No, it's all of us. We're all called to this mission. Let me change direction just a little bit. So me and my wife, Hope, we were hanging out at this place called Blue Garden. How many of you guys have heard of Blue Garden here in the city? Okay. It's kind of this cool spot. You go there and there's like food trucks all over. You go in, it's kind of like an outdoor food court basically. And so we went up to this food truck, got some chicken. I'm walking away, and as I was walking away, I saw on the truck that it said Psalm 23 on the side of the truck. And I tapped my wife and I said, "Hey babe, look, they must be Christian. They got Psalm 23 on their side." And my wife just kind of looks at me, she's like, "Yeah. Probably not." And I sat there while I'm eating my chicken. And I was like, you know what? Like, how could I know if they're Christian or not? Like, Psalm 23, just to put it out there, is just one of the most popular passages in all of Scripture, right? Like, there's a few of those, right? There's Psalm 23, there's John 3:16. Everybody knows it, right? If you've been to a funeral, you know Psalm 23. Right? If you watch WWF growing up, you know John 3:16. Stone Cold Steve Austin. Some of y'all know. Okay? It's just like if the scriptures were an anthology, those few passages would be like the greatest hits. Everybody knows it. You know, if I walked up to you, and I'm a huge Coldplay fan. If I walked up to you and I said, you know, are you a Coldplay fan too? And you're like, yeah, I'm a huge Coldplay fan. I'd be like, okay, what are some of your favorite songs? And you're like, oh, I love Adventure of a Lifetime and Clocks. And I said, well, you know, everybody knows those songs. Like, those are Coldplay's, like, greatest hits. Like, but what are the other songs that you know? And you didn't know songs like Parachutes. If you didn't know songs like Spies or Swallowed in the Sea, some of y'all looking like, what is he talking about? Like, if you didn't know those are like the deep tracks. Like, back in the day when you bought entire CDs, not just one song. Like, those are the deep tracks. And if you are a real fan, like not a casual fan, but a committed fan, you know. You know, there's some people who call themselves believers, and they may be good-hearted believers, right? And they say that their favorite book on Facebook is the Bible. But all they know is like the greatest hits. They don't know the deep tracks of Scripture. I want to challenge us and look at a deep track of Scripture today, okay? Something deep. And if you've read this passage before, I promise you, if you're reading through the book of Luke and you came across this one, you are confused, right? Like, it is one of those passages you're like, what did I just read? And so we're going to look at this together, and it's going to be a little bit challenging, but I want us to stick together on this, okay? So if you have your Bibles, Luke chapter 16, we're going to look at verse 1 through 13. Luke 16, 1 through 13. Now, this is Jesus speaking. He also said to the disciples, there was a rich man who had a manager, and charges were brought to him that this man was wasting his possessions. And he called him and said to him, what is this that I hear about you? Turn in the account of your management so you can no longer be manager. So basically what's about to happen is this owner, this rich man, is about to fire this manager for poorly managing his property. And so basically he says, hey, I want you to go ahead, put all your accounts together, bring it to me so that I can go ahead and let you go. Verse 3, the manager said to himself, what shall I do since my master is taking the management away from me? I'm not strong enough to dig and I'm ashamed to beg. And then he says this, I have decided what to do. Literally, aha, I know what I'm going to do. So that when I'm removed from the management, people may receive me into their homes. Now, I want you to pay close attention to what's happening here. He's not trying to save his job. He's saying, hey, I know what I'll do so that I can kind of ensure my future once I get fired from here. And so this is what he does. So, summoning his master's debtors one by one, he said to the first, how much do you owe my master? He said, 100 measures of oil. He said to him, take your bill, sit down, and quickly write 50. Now, do you see what's happening? He calls this guy who owes his master 100 measures, and he cuts him a deal. And he says, you know what? Now you only owe 50. Like, he gave him a 50% discount. Like, I wish this guy managed my student loans. Like, come on, Jesus. Verse 7, then he said to another, how much do you owe? He said, 100 measures of wheat. He said to him, take your bill and write 80. So not quite deep as 50. Verse 8, the master commended the dishonest manager. Now, if you're Jesus' original audience, your minds are just blown. Like, why would Jesus put these words in his mouth? Why would he speak of this person as the owner would look at this guy and commend him? Literally, the word means to praise. He praised the dishonest manager for his shrewdness. Now, that's a word we don't use a lot. Like, how many times after a Thunder game do you say, oh, man, Russell Westbrook was just so shrewd today? Like, never. It's just not a word we use. It simply means that he was wise, that he was cunning. So the master praises this dishonest manager for his cunning, his wisdom. And then Jesus says this very peculiar line. He said, for the sons of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. The sons of this world are more shrewd, are more wise in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. And that's a really peculiar statement, why Jesus would say that. But I think it holds up, right? Like, some of you guys, when I threw these numbers on the board, you're like, oh my God, can we say that in church? Like, that sounds too businessy. That's, like, if you're like me, that bothers you just a little bit. A little flag goes up. But if you go ask Facebook what their click-to-conversion ratio is, they know it. If you go ask Apple about their corporation, their demographics, they know it. Go ask the top corporations in our world. Jesus says it, the sons of this world are more shrewd, are more wise in handling their own kind than we, the children of light, are. Sometimes we as a church get afraid of things like this. We stay away from it. But the reality is that we have a mission in this world, and Jesus spells it out. He says, and I tell you, make friends for yourself by means of unrighteous wealth, literally worldly wealth, so that when it fails, they may receive you into the eternal dwellings. Basically, Jesus says this: use your resources, use your wealth, use your money to win friends, to win people to Jesus, to the kingdom, so that in the end, you can't take any of that with you, but you can take your friends, and they'll be home welcoming you to heaven. Verse 10, one who is faithful with very little is also faithful in much, and one who is dishonest in very little is also dishonest in much. If then you have not been faithful in the unrighteous wealth, who will entrust you with true riches? And if you have not been faithful in that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he'll be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money. Now, this is where people get hung up on this passage. Because when you get to that verse, everyone's like, oh, clearly Jesus is talking about money. This whole passage is about money. Well, yes, he certainly is talking about money, but he's talking about something far more important than money. He's talking about people, right? Through this parable, Jesus outlines for us one simple idea. Basically, he's outlining us for is this, that how you value money says a lot about how you value people. And how you value people says everything about how you value God. Let me say that again. How you value money says a lot about how you value people, and how you value people says everything about how you value God. And so, yes, this passage certainly deals with money, but it deals with so much more than money. It deals with how you value people. Today, I want to talk to you about relationships. Because I think that is the core arsenal we have in our toolbox when it comes to reaching the world for the kingdom. How we handle relationships says everything about how we value people, and that says everything about how we value God. And so I'm going to take a little bit of a cut back here, okay? We're going to go a little bit of a different direction. I've been here at North Church for about 6.5 years, and I feel like I've learned a lot in that time. But there are probably three lessons when it comes to relationships that I've held on to the most, the closest. And so what I simply want to do today is just kind of spell that out for you. So here's the first and probably most important lesson that I learned in the last 6.5 years at North Church. And that is this: relational equity is everything. Relational equity is everything. When I first started on staff, you know, I wanted to be good at my job, and I want to be good and a good employee. So I went to Pastor Rodney. I said, Pastor Rodney, you know, what should I do? And he says, read everything by Patrick Lencioni and read everything by John Maxwell. And he gave me this book. It's called Developing the Leader Within You by John Maxwell. And within the first few chapters, John Maxwell outlines this principle called relational equity. And I just want to spell it out for you. So this is not original to me. This is kind of John Maxwell, right? And basically what he says is this. He says, imagine a bank. And let's just say this is your bank, okay? And let's say you put in your bank $100. Now I'm going to ask you a very simple question. What is the most amount of money you can pull out of your bank? $100, right? What would happen if you were to pull out $101? Overdraft fees, wife's not happy, dog's not happy, life's not happy, right? Nothing's going great when that happens. And John Maxwell says, this is how relationships work. And I know it sounds kind of transactional. Let me clarify it a little bit. You know, if I were to go up to my friend Heidi, and I said, Heidi, hey, I need this, I need a favor, and I were to ask her for something, but I've never invested in that relationship. You know, Heidi might be a nice person. She may feel like she needs to invest in my relational bank. And she may do me that favor that one time, and then I come back to her again, and then she does it again, and then I come back. And so the next time I'm looking for her, she's trying to avoid me, right? Come on, how many of you guys have somebody that you know every time they call, you see the caller ID and you're like, oh, I'm about to lose some money. That's relational equity. If you've never invested into someone, you can never take out. You can only take out as much as you put in. And I know that sounds a little bit transactional, but let me illustrate a little bit further. So when I first started working at North Church, basically it was just me and several guys who were all around my age, all kind of came on staff at all at the same time. Basically, we were like Pastor Rodney's youth group. And we needed somebody to come and kind of take us under their wing and guide us and help us grow up into being men. And a person that helped me along the way and did that for me was Pastor Clint. And Pastor Clint played a big role in my life. But one of the stories that I can never forget, that I will always kind of think back to, was early on in my time here, Pastor Clint decided to take all of us young men out shopping for shoes. Now, if you know Pastor Clint, you know that he has impeccable taste in shoes. Okay, in fact, if you see him today, just look down at his shoes. He's got a good pair on even today. Okay, and so we go shopping for shoes, and I found a pair that I liked, and I got Pastor Clint's approval. He gave me a thumbs up. I walk up to the counter, and I'm about to pay. I pull out my wallet, and Pastor Clint stops me. He says, "Hey, man, let me get that for you." And I don't know why, but to this day, I cannot forget that moment. I don't know why it's that one thing that has stuck with me all these years. But I realized something. I mean, it wasn't an expensive pair of shoes. It was like $30. But I realized something. That this person is not looking to take out. He's looking to invest. And he's always continued to invest. Pastor Clint's always believed me. He's the reason that I've grown here. He's the reason I've married the person that I've married. He's believed in us more than we believed in us. And to this day, Pastor Clint can walk up here and ask me anything, and pretty much anything I would do for Pastor Clint. But can I tell you something interesting about Pastor Clint? He rarely does ask for very much. In fact, most of the time he's looking to pour into me. He's looking to invest in my life. Relational equity is everything. You know, there's some relationships in your life right now. Maybe that coworker that you sit across from, and you're wondering why they're so angry all the time, they're so crabby. Maybe it's because no one's invested in them. And if you would just take an extra second and invest in them, however that means for you, that would change the outlook of their day, of their week, of their life. Maybe it's your spouse. Maybe there's a long time since the last time you invested something. Maybe you've only taken out. Maybe it's time to invest in that relationship. All of us have those relationships that we are called to invest in. The book of Proverbs says this: a generous person will prosper. Whoever refreshes others will be refreshed. Relational equity is everything. Here's number two, if you're following along. Number two is this: authenticity is everything. Authenticity is everything. If I were to do a little tagline there, I'll say this: be you. Be you. Because being somebody else is just exhausting. Be authentically who you are. Now, some of you guys may know Pastor Hetty. Those of you in Guthrie know him really well. He's our pastor at Guthrie. And if you know him, you know he's like the most happy, positive person on the planet. He's just always happy. In fact, Monday morning, every Monday morning we have our staff meeting. And so we come in at 8:30, and I kind of just limp in until I get my coffee. You know what I'm saying? Anybody else like me? Come on. So I'm just kind of limping in. Pastor Hetty's always at the front of the door hugging every single person as they come in. Like they should give him a job at Walmart. Like he's just that good. He's just always happy. Go in. You know, it's like that's his thing. Here's the thing. I'm not Pastor Hetty. Like I don't have enough happy to be Pastor Hetty. It's just not me. So I have to be who I'm made to be. I have to be authentic to who I am. But it goes beyond that. So if let me give you a little bit of caveat, right? So not only am I supposed to be me, to be authentic to who I am, but I'm called to be the best version of me. To be the best version of me. I remember when Hope and I went on our first date. It had been a while since I'd been on a date. And so somebody just laughed at that. Okay. And so I was so unsure about it. I didn't know what to do. So I went to the source of all knowledge on the internet, YouTube. And I typed in how to go on a first date. All right, y'all Owen over there, let me tell you, it worked. I have a ring on, okay? Okay, it worked. This video pulls up, and this lady talking, and she gives the best piece of advice. She said, be you, but be the best version of you. And I don't think that's pop psychology. I don't think that's just the world speaking. I think that's what Scripture says, that we're called to be transformed by the renewing of our minds. Right? The more we pursue Christ-likeness, to be like Him, the more we become the way we're created to be. Authentically who we are, the best version of who we are. But number two, let me give you this. Be vulnerable. Be vulnerable. So when we got married, we decided to start a small group for young couples because that's what we were. And it wasn't because we knew anything. In fact, we didn't know anything. And so we wanted to call a group of other people that didn't know anything, and we'd watch a video of somebody that did know something. And then we would discuss it. And if you know my wife, you know she's an open book. Like, she's just super vulnerable all the time to everyone. And so during the discussion time, she would always open up the discussion by talking about our last fight the previous week. And then the rest of the group would basically be this. People would go around in a circle, and they would give us all their marriage advice for us to have a better marriage. And so I looked at Hope one day, and I was like, listen, babe, maybe this time we don't have to go first. Let somebody else throw their dirty laundry out. But you know what happened? Over the course of a year, that group started changing. Because we were being vulnerable, they started being vulnerable. Man, people started confessing their sins, their struggles, their habits, their addictions. They started opening up in such powerful and unique ways. When we were willing to air our dirty laundry, so were they. When we were willing to tell on ourselves, so were they. So if you want to have strong relationships, be vulnerable, right? Be authentically you. Here's the last one. Navigating conflict is everything. Navigating conflict is everything. Now, if you know me, you know I hate confrontation. Like, it's just not me. Like, I see a problem, and I do one of these. Like, oh, that's not my problem. You know, I just, that is not me. But luckily, I've had leaders in my life for the last 6.5 years who said, you know what, let's turn you around, and you need to walk towards that problem. And so many times in our life, we see problems, we see people, and we call them problems. And instead of helping or dealing, we walk away. Because we don't want to get messy. We don't want to get dirty. But that's exactly what God calls us to do. In fact, Jesus says, you know what? Go into all the world. He literally could have said, go into all the problems. Because that's what we're called to. All the messiness, all the dirt, we're supposed to be there. That's our role as the church. So when Hope and I first started getting serious in our relationship and we were starting to talk about marriage, I thought the challenge was going to be on my side of the family, the relationship that we would have with my parents. Because just so you guys know, my parents always assumed that I would marry a nice little Indian girl. And it turns out Hope is more Caucasian than South Asian. And so it didn't to me, in my head, it didn't line up with their expectations. So I still remember this conversation I had with Pastor Rodney, sitting in his office, and I said, hey, what if I just wait till like the week before the wedding and then tell them? And he says, Samson, if you never tell them, you never give them an opportunity to do the right thing. You have to go talk to them. And so I remember telling them about hope. And, you know, I was beautifully surprised by their openness. I mean, they certainly had a challenge, but they welcomed hope. And to this day, I think they actually love her more than they love me. They were just happy to have somebody else to feed. They love feeding people, guys. And if we don't go over there, like, in a week, like, I will get a text from my dad and be like, Samson, we have food. Like, that's their bait. So I thought that's where the challenge would be. But I was actually wrong. The challenge we really faced came from our relationship with Hope's parents. See, Hope grew up in a very fundamentalist Baptist background. And the challenge there was this, that they grew up in a church that thought of churches like ours that played rock and roll music as the devil's church. And everyone who didn't use the King James Version of the Bible was using the devil's Bible. And to be honest, it probably didn't help that I was a little brown. And so when they found out that she was going to marry the devil's pastor, that did not sound like something they wanted to be on board with. 2 weeks before our wedding, Hope got a phone call from her dad. And he basically said some things that no dad should ever say to a daughter. They didn't attend our wedding. And we knew that was going to be a challenging relationship. About a year later, last Christmas actually, Hope got a phone call from her dad. And he wanted to have dinner with all of us. And I got home that day. I could tell there was something wrong. And I said, babe, what's wrong? And she explained to me that her dad called, and she doesn't know what to do and how to handle it. And I said, listen, let me talk to him first. So I picked up the phone, called him. And I said, hi, this is Samson. I'm your son-in-law. We hadn't talked yet. And I said, hey, I know you wanted to have all of us over for dinner, but I think it'd be better if you and I were to meet first, since you guys didn't attend the wedding, and I just want to be on the same page, and I just want us to talk man to man. Is that okay? And he said, sure. I hung up the phone, and I said, oh, Jesus, what am I going to do? And so I went to my version of what I call the relational Yoda. That's Pastor Clint. And I said, Pastor Clint, what do I do? And he helped me walk through that situation. He said, hey, there's two things that you need to remember. One, you need to protect whatever possibility of a relationship that Hope can have with her family. So whatever you do, preserve that opportunity. But two, protect your wife. No matter what you say, what you do, protect your wife in that conversation. So walked into that conversation. We met the day before Christmas Eve at the Penn Square Mall food court, the worst place to meet anyone. I walk up there to the food court, stuck out my hand to shake his hand. He shook my hand. The very first words that he said were, you know, you look nicer than I thought you would. I really didn't know what that meant. I took it as a compliment. We sat down together. And I wish I could tell you that it was a pleasant conversation from there. It wasn't. For the next 20 minutes, he basically berated my wife. And I just stopped him. And I said, listen, he's going to stop you right here. I just wanted to tell you that if the roles were reversed, and if you were saying the things, or if I was saying the things that you were saying about your wife, you probably wouldn't let this conversation continue. So if we see a potential in this, let's change the course of this conversation and let's talk about something we can agree on. And so we did. And the next morning, we had breakfast with her family for the first time. Now, I wish I could tell you that that relationship has healed. It's not. It's far from healing, but perhaps that's a start to the process. But I do know this, that if I didn't go in to that conversation willing to navigate the conflict, then we would never have the possibility of a relationship. Can I tell you, relationships are the most important tool in your arsenal to reach the world for Jesus. How you invest in others, how authentic, truthful, vulnerable you are to others, and how willing you are to navigate the messiness of life with others will say everything about how you value people, and how you value people says everything about how you value God. There's some of us in this room, and you have some relationships you're still trying to figure out. Some relationships that you haven't invested in for years. Some relationships where you've been so fake, you've never been your true self with that person. Some relationships that you've been sitting on a conflict and never willing to talk about it. Some could be with family, some could be with friends, coworkers. But whatever that is, I want to tell you, those relationships are so important in your role as the church to reach the world. Those are the people that not only need to hear the gospel, they need to feel the gospel from you.